You are listening to Mountain Money, broadcasting from KPCW, Park City, Utah.
Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. Today is March 8th. I'm Doug Wells, and I'm joined this morning with my wonderful co-host, Allison Kulo. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Doug.
And boy, spring skiing has arrived in Park City.
I know. I think watching everyone in my neighborhood walk around in shirt sleeves yesterday, I don't know if I can go back.
Yeah. No, it's always fun when it comes, and one of my favorite things is to hang out at the beachfront, the snow beachfronts in front of some of the lodges, and just enjoy this. The next month until closing season is just going to be wonderful. So we hope everybody's having fun. We have a great show for you this morning. Our first guest is going to be an entrepreneurship coach and branding mentor named Charlene Walters. She's going to talk about her new book, Launch Your Inner Entrepreneur, 10 Mindset Shifts for Women to Take Action, Unleash Creativity, and Achieve Financial Success.
We'll then go to CNBC.com's airline reporter, Leslie Josephs. She's going to join us this morning to talk about the airline rebound and what travelers should know for upcoming travel.
And then our final guest is going to be our station manager, Renee Bodley Miller, and she's going to tell us about how we did in Pledge Drive last week. So it's going to be a great show. You're listening to Mountain Money. Please stay tuned.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. With tens of millions unemployed and a pandemic wreaking havoc on traditional businesses, everyone is scrambling to find alternative ways to take control of their own livelihoods and earnings. And unfortunately, women have been more severely impacted. Recent labor statistics have reported that around 1.1 million Americans left the workforce at the end of last year, and that nearly 80% of them are women.
It's clear that displaced workers need additional support right now, and entrepreneurship may be an attractive option for some people. In fact, 42% of all small businesses or franchise owners are women, and there are 13 million women-owned businesses contributing up to $1.9 trillion in revenue to the U.S. economy. Still, despite these facts, research shows that women business owners struggle with more with certain facets of entrepreneurship than men, and that might be thwarting their success.
Joining us this morning to explore women and entrepreneurship is coach and branding mentor Charlene Walters. Walter serves as a guide for the fledgling entrepreneur in her candid, compelling, and practical playbook for building a business and a life from the ground up. In her recently released book, Launch Your Inner Entrepreneur, 10 Mindset Shifts for Women to Take Action, Unleash Creativity, and Achieve Financial Success. Charlene, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks so much for having me on, Allison, Doug. I'm so happy to be here today.
Well, thank you for being here. I'd like to first start off with, can you tell us about how female entrepreneurs reshaped the business world in 2020?
Definitely. So many women, as you mentioned, left the workforce in 2020, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that they were more impacted by furloughs and layoffs, and some just left because they had all of these additional obligations placed on them due to homeschooling and additional family demands. So entrepreneurship really was an attractive option for many of these women because it allowed them to get control of their career, their schedule, their flexibility. And because of that, we've seen record numbers of women launching businesses.
And so this is a tough time to launch a business. So I'm surprised to hear you say that so many businesses are being started now as opposed to maybe waiting for a better period. Help us think through how people are thinking about what additional challenges there might be to entrepreneurship now that maybe normally would not exist.
What I think many entrepreneurs are doing is they're taking advantage of the time home. So perhaps even if they haven't yet launched their business, they are getting their plans together. You know, we're all stuck at home. We've got plenty of time in our hands. And if we've always dreamed about becoming an entrepreneur, this might be a good time. And as I recommend with any entrepreneurs, it's important to take a look at the market and see what new opportunities are coming up. So now we're seeing a rise in those businesses that can support people while they're at home. So anything having to do with supporting busy parents who are homeschooling, tutoring, et cetera, is big right now. we're also seeing a big boom in repair services, if you can believe it, because we're at home more. Things are getting broken. We also see home decor taking off and anything that we can provide to embrace safe entertainment because we're also bored. So it's really about identifying those opportunities that have come about now as a pandemic, as a result of the pandemic, and really kind of tailoring our businesses around them.
So knowing that the pandemic has given us then the sense of understanding the marketplace in a new marketplace, but are there any things that entrepreneurs should keep in mind going into 2021, kind of other than the pandemic?
Yes. So I think we have to keep an eye on what's coming out long term. So there will be a lot of, once things normalize, if they do normalize, or as much as they will normalize, we'll see the needs of our customers changing. So that's really what we have to keep an eye on. And many small businesses that were operating during the pandemic, they've had to find new and creative ways to reach their customers and to better service them, whether that meant having virtual events or bringing products or services to them. And I think we just, as entrepreneurs, have to keep an eye on those changing needs of the changing market, because as we grow and progress as consumers, as markets open up, as things shift, we just need to shift with them.
And one of the things I said in the open was that there may be certain facets of entrepreneurship that women might struggle with differently than men. Could you explain to the audience what some of those facets are?
Yes, definitely. So entrepreneurship, really the success that you have, has to do with just having the right attitude. So women have some difficulties, and it's not to say that men don't also suffer from some of these areas, but sometimes they're a little less likely to take risks. They need a little help with time management, not because they're not good at managing their time, but often the greater responsibility falls on them in relation to their household obligations, and they need to get better about balancing all of that and really putting themselves in self-care first, as counterintuitive as that might seem. Because the more well-rested, the better taken care of they are, the better off their business will be. And they also sometimes have issues in terms of self-confidence. There's something known as the confidence gap between men and women. And there are some famous studies out there you've probably heard, but there's one particular where men would apply for positions when they only had 60% of the qualifications versus women who only apply when they have 100%. And that has to do with our need as women. We really want to be perfect before we put ourselves front and center. And as entrepreneurs, we won't be perfect and we'll be jumping into something new. So there's many things related to self-esteem, you know, just trumpeting our accomplishments and more.
And do you mind following up on that? I know in your book you talk about 10 mine aspects that folks need to switch in entrepreneurship, and share with our audience a few of those.
Sure. So the first one is taking action, because entrepreneurship starts with taking a giant leap, which is scary for many of us. We don't want to give up that beautiful paycheck we have coming in, and we have to keep taking that leap, moving forward with everything related to our business, and then developing the resilience. That's part of it, another mindset shift, to be able to come away from those obstacles, those setbacks, those failures, and keep moving forward. So, for example, you know, everyone has times where they feel pain, they feel that failure, they feel that rejection. And sometimes, if we're not careful, we can let that talk ourselves out of running a business. So for me, for example, I still have those times where I feel a minor rejection or I feel a setback. And what I do is come up with a coping strategy to get over it. So, for example, recently something happened I didn't like. I decided, you know what, I'm not doing well at my business. I don't have any more meetings this afternoon. I'm taking an hour off. I'm spending some time with my kids. I'm going for a run, and I'm going to come back to this when I'm in a better mood. And that's really what it's about, being able to get out of those pitfalls. There's also some advice related to leadership and then building your personal brand and putting yourself front and center, particularly on social media, where we make so many connections, and it's such a great opportunity to network with others in our industry and in general and pick up new clients.
So a lot of the items that you've talked about with regards to the mind shifts that are crucial for female entrepreneurs really comes back to, confidence, I think, when you had talked about that. And it's something that I can self-identify with. So when you talk about branding and putting yourself on, you know, social media, or you talk about, you know, just taking that first step to action, what's a good way for people to kind of overcome that imposter syndrome and, you know, fight that self-sabotage?
So imposter syndrome is really big for a lot of people, and it's that feeling, of course, that you don't belong and you've only gotten lucky. And what I suggest for many women, for anyone in general who's suffering with imposter syndrome, is to make a list of all those things you've done, your accomplishments, your achievements, your skills, your qualities, even ask for friends to contribute to it, and hang it somewhere for those days when your confidence wanes and you really need it, refer back to it. I also tell people if they are going to have something big coming up, a big pitch, a big presentation, a big interview, to plan a night out or a virtual night out now. Either way, have an ups and downs buddy. That way, if it's success, you can celebrate that success. If it's a failure, you have someone to commiserate with. And just learning that from every failure, from everything that happens to us, we actually learn something. So it's getting to look at things, looking at the silver lining. I also recommend practicing and preparing for anything that you don't feel confident going into. As you all know, that the more prepared we are, the better we'll do before it. And so we can even record ourselves on Zoom, you know, try to look through. We could practice with a friend, whatever we can do to boost ourselves up.
If you're just joining us this morning, we're speaking with Charlene Walters. She is the author of the book, Launch Your Inner Entrepreneur, 10 Mindset Shifts for Women to Take Action, Unleash Creativity, and Achieve Financial Success. So we've talked about a couple of those mindset shifts. We don't want to go through all 10. We want to encourage people to buy your book, after all. But give us another one or two of those mindset shifts that women in particular should think about.
So another one has to do with leadership. And when it comes to leadership, you know, it's about more than just being a manager. It's you're running the ship. You know, people have to look up for you. And particularly now during the pandemic, leadership is challenging because we're often leading remotely. So what I really suggest for women is to lean into flexibility and empathy and find a balance. When it comes to communication, you know, it can be lonely and you can be isolated at home. And people are going through so much, you know, taking care of sick relatives, just having a lot on their plate. So I suggest for women leaders, entrepreneurs, to manage their team in a way where they are paying attention to their milestones, that they're meeting their goals, but not really focusing on their hours per se, as long as they're getting everything done. And that's important. The more flexible and empathetic we are with our team, the more likely they'll be to push our business forward. They'll be more committed, more loyal. It really comes back to us. So there's certain tips in there related to leadership, and particularly, you know, team building and bonding in a remote work environment.
As you've mentioned, empathizing with your team, I think coming back to a point that you had made earlier, you know, taking care of yourself while you're doing this. So you've mentioned, you know, flexibility, and many times women already have a full plate. How would you guide new entrepreneurs as they get started from becoming, all absorbed into that project? Because it is what you're trying to do. It is trying to, bring money to your household and put food on the table. How do you make it not all-encompassing?
I've really put an emphasis on time management and telling women that they should dedicate certain hours a day to their business. And obviously, this won't be set in stone. But maybe you say you're going to set 8 to 5 to business, and then you have 5 to 8 for your family, and then 8 to 10 for yourself. Whatever it is, have a loose idea and try to stick with it as much as possible. I'm a single mom. My husband, unfortunately, passed away when my kids were young. And so I've had to just, out of necessity, become a master schedule with everything that I want to do and with my children. And I also really suggest that you communicate with those stakeholders in your life, the people that are important to you. I always talk to my children about the schedule. They tell me what they need to do, and I just make it a point to say, okay, I'm working during this time, but I have these hours available for you. And I think the more we communicate, the more everybody understands that we're all balancing together, the better off it will be. And just to really not to beat yourself up while you're trying to do things. Sometimes you might have to take an hour off in the afternoon for something for your family or another obligation, and that's okay. You can come back to it later on in the day when you have a chance. And the more we manage our time and we try to eliminate distractions, the more we can get done in less time. So I give some tips for lessening those distractions and taking control of those items we want to do to every day, really listing two or three big things that we want to accomplish, and then working in chunks to make them happen.
Yeah, really important points, because the challenge for any entrepreneur, the challenge for anybody working hard is balance. You know, when you want to achieve certain goals in the business world, there are sacrifices that you have to make, but making sure you're thoughtful about which sacrifices you're willing to make and which ones you don't. Because as a parent, that's a special time, and you only get to play that role for a certain number of years. So you want to look back and be glad about how you chose to spend your time. You know, it's serendipity, Charlene, that you shared with us about losing your husband, and we're sorry to hear about your family's loss there. And I say it's serendipity because earlier you used the phrase lean into, which is a phrase that was, you know, really popularized by Sheryl Sandberg, who's the chief operating officer and board member at Facebook. And I was going to ask you if by chance, you know, she's an icon female business leader. I was going to ask you if by chance in your work, your passive cross with Sheryl, in either way, what lessons do you think you would like our audience to learn from whether you've met with Sheryl, or I'm sure I consider myself to be a student of some of her advice, but as a student of her advice as well, what concepts would you want to share with our audience from her?
So I have not met her, but I did quote her in my book, and I really like the tips she provides for negotiation and kind of inserting yourself into the conversation as a woman. I think they're so important. She talks about building rapport and coming to the table with multiple options and working to come up with a solution that works for everyone. In negotiation and pitching are important for entrepreneurs, they're important for women, because so often, even women in the corporate world, will not get in there and negotiate. Their salaries will not get in there and negotiate. And she is such a great example of how we can stand up for ourselves and negotiate and really make our voices be heard. So that's what I've learned from her, and I really applaud her work.
I know as we all move forward in life, we need mentors. And one of the things about mentors, you know, they've got your back, but why is it important to find a mentor that holds you accountable?
It is so important, because so many women and so many entrepreneurs that I meet with, they have so many ideas and so many good intentions. But unfortunately, sometimes that can be so overwhelming because there's so many things we want to do. We sometimes don't even know where to support. So having a mentor who kind of holds you accountable, talks you through your ideas and what you want to do next, is key to making it happen and to making progress. I love working with entrepreneurs who talk about things they want to do, and then I see them going forward. And I can just be there to give them that nudge, to cheer them on, and to help them. And sometimes that's really all we need. The concept of mentoring has evolved over the years. It used to be we had one mentor who kind of helped us within one company over our whole life. And now we're moving around. We're starting our own businesses. So it's important just to find that person that we can lean on and who will really have our back and make sure we're doing all the things that we say we're going to do.
And related to that, you talked earlier about some of the issues that women face. And I know with some of the women that I've worked with in my past, and my wife's a professional as well, a common comment that I hear is, you know, gee, I don't, you mentioned this earlier, I don't feel I have enough experience. And for whatever reason, in the last 10 years, 7 years, we've come up with a phrase for that. It's called imposter syndrome. People feel like they're an imposter. They don't feel comfortable. And I do find it much more common with my female friends than it is with my guy friends. You know, my guy friends are like, well, we'll make it up as we go if we have to. But that's less common for women. And what advice do you have for them to get over that? Because the reality is, you know, probably half of your time you're doing something that maybe you've done tangentially close to it, but you haven't faced this exact situation. So we're all there, and it's really important to learn to be comfortable when you're in a situation where you might not have direct experience with.
It's really important for women to recognize it when it's happening. I think that's key, because we can really talk ourselves out of things and kind of ruin all that we have. And we really have to tell ourselves that it's nonsense. It's just something we're telling ourselves. It's not the reality about us. And again, listing those accomplishments is big, but I also recommend that women come up with a mantra like, Mary, you've got this, you know, Charlene, you can do it. Whatever it is, just to tell themselves so that they can instantly see that pattern happening, that way of thinking, and then thwart it and kind of turn it around on them. Again, preparation is really big. And I also suggest, you know, as entrepreneurs, sometimes we feel like we're not doing enough, we're not good enough, whatever it is having to do with our upbringing, something that happened to us. So maybe keeping a journal of everything you're doing and then kind of going back through it and really celebrating your accomplishments and all those things you've done. Because as women, I think we are a little bit tougher on ourselves. It's sort of the way we are raised. And again, it goes back to that need for perfection. And we're not going to be that. But we're good about a lot of things. And we just have to keep reminding ourselves of that.
As we work to wrap up this interview, wondering if you could share with us why it's important to you to help women in business.
So I read a stat recently that around 46% of all women are the primary or co-breadwinners for their family, which is huge. And if we think back to our past when men were the primary breadwinners, and it's kind of shifted in a big way. And as I mentioned, because my husband passed away, I found myself in that exact situation alone. I didn't really see a lot of people that were in my situation. So I'm always sure to talk about the fact that I am alone and raising my kids on my own, and that I am the primary breadwinner. And it's very important for me to help other women who are like me, who may be out there facing the same thing and really just wanting the best for themselves and their family. And I think because we had so many women leave the workforce last year, it's just the time for that. And I personally feel so rewarded when I'm able to help women that are like myself or any women in general just lift up their life through entrepreneurship.
Well, that's a great note for us to end on. And thank you for sharing that story of encouragement with us. We've been speaking with author Charlene Walters. She is the author of the book, Launch Your Inner Entrepreneur, 10 Mindset Shifts for Women to Take Action, Unleash Creativity, and Achieve Financial Success. Charlene, thank you for joining us, and Mountain Money will be back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. We're going to shift gears now, and we're going to talk about the airline industry. As many of us are seeing, folks are beginning to start to venture out and travel again, which is great news for the airline industry. At one point, the TSA checkpoint traffic was down over 90%. So America literally just quit flying for the most part. It was down over 95%. And joining us this morning to talk about the airline industry, we're honored to have a CNBC reporter, CNBC's airline reporter, Leslie Joseph, is joining us this morning. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
We're doing well. And more importantly, how is the airline industry doing? So, you know, some people have ventured into the airports. And when I had friends that went fairly early in the pandemic, they would tell me how airy it was. You know, they're in these airports that were traditionally just packed. And now when people are talking to me, the airports aren't airy anymore. They're starting to feel normal again. Where is the state of the airline industry today?
Well, in short, things are still pretty bad. So there's really no way to sugarcoat that. They lost $35 billion last year. The passenger volume fell to the lowest level since 1984. Last year was very painful for the airlines. But now, like you said, I mean, some of these things we hear, maybe they're anecdotal, and we're hearing that airports are getting a little bit more crowded. Friends will tell you, my flight was full or it looked full. People are starting to go back out and travel and fly. And part of that is because more people are getting vaccinated. And also people have been stuck at home for the better part of a year.
I know that, you know, part of that loss, as you've mentioned, included the need for the airlines to be able to reduce their employment numbers, whether that be with those that work on a plane or those that work at the airport. How are airlines coming back? How are they kind of rebuilding their staff as they see the rebound coming?
Well, like you said, there was a lot of job loss last year. American and United ended up furloughing over 30,000, or warning employees that they would be furloughed, more than 30,000 employees. Because the entire U.S. airline industry has been receiving more government aid and is now on the cusp of getting another several billion dollars in support to pay those workers, a lot of those involuntary furloughs have been avoided. So that's something that is a relief to a lot of employees. How long the aid will go on, we don't know yet. But airlines were also last year urging people to take early retirement packages, take buyouts, take extended leaves of absence, and that led to tens of thousands of job cuts. And now the airlines, things are starting to turn around again. So some of the airlines that had pretty simple business models, like Spirit Airlines, for example, just a discount carrier, you know, low overhead, it's a low-cost airline, simple, one kind of plane. They didn't have the international exposure that a lot of the large airlines had, and they had to quickly cut because of COVID and travel restrictions. Pretty straightforward leisure carrier in the United States. They are starting to hire pilots and flight attendants again. So it is kind of like this green shoot, you know, maybe things are turning around. The larger carriers have a long way to go because they do have more complex businesses, they have different kinds of planes, they fly all over the world, and it's a little bit of more of an adjustment for them.
So you're talking about business strategies. Spirit's an example of a low-cost leader. Let's stay on the topic of how the airlines are thinking about the situation strategically. You know, many airlines have gone back to, we're going to sell every seat that's on the plane. There's at least one example, Delta, where I think until the end of April, they're leaving the middle seat open. Talk to the audience, to us about, you know, why the airlines are taking different approaches. Why would one airline choose to leave middle seats open and another one choose to go back to normal operations as quickly as possible?
Yeah, we have seen kind of a divergence with that policy. So pretty early on in the pandemic, some airlines were keeping middle seats open. Southwest, Delta, as you mentioned, continues to leave the middle seat open. But for the most part, airlines have gone back to selling every seat on board. And the simple answer to that is revenue. And even Southwest said when they got rid of that policy of keeping this middle seat open, they did see a bump, and it was beneficial to them. And Delta has also, the airline that continues to leave middle seats open at least for a few more weeks at minimum, they have been careful to say that it's not a safety issue. Airline executives will repeatedly tell you the chances of catching COVID on an airplane are very low because of filtration systems and so forth, but it does give some travelers, at least that extra sense of physical distance from one passenger to another. But as we all know who've been on an airplane, there's not a lot of opportunity for physical distancing. When you're standing in the aisle, you're putting your suitcase up, you're, you know, deplaning, boarding, and things like that.
Yeah, I think strategically another change we've heard a lot about in the news, and I as a consumer hope that it stays in place post-pandemic, which is it used to be really painful as a leisure traveler if something came up and you had to change your flight. Oftentimes, you basically had to write off the value of the entire flight with the change fees. Those are gone now. What do you think that change is here to stay? And what do you think the impact is to the airline industry of that change?
I mean, the word permanent doesn't always go with the airline industry. So things can always change again. But like you mentioned, last year, the airlines got rid of change fees. At first, they started small, and they were just doing domestic flights or, you know, short-haul international flights. And they've expanded that, big three carriers anyway, to international. So will that stay? It's hard to say. If they need the revenue in the future, it could reverse at some point. But a result of this crisis, I mean, if you remember even before the crisis, airlines were looking to charge you a fee for for anything, you know, sit closer to the front of the plane, not even an extra legroom seat, just advanced seat selection. We're seeing more restrictive fares. You know, you can't put your bag in the overhead bin if you have the cheapest fare on JetBlue. That's a recent change. So there are a lot of the seat fees, baggage fees, those have remained. But quietly, airlines have been forced to be a little bit nicer to their customers. They are desperate to fill their airplanes and to get rid of a fee that seemed like we would be paying it until the end of time. I mean, things had to get pretty bad, and we know how bad they had to get. But they would rather passengers make those bookings. Of course, like airlines pocket that money, you know, before you fly. So they want that revenue. And if it's going to encourage more travelers to book and have that sort of freedom, what if I want to come back a day early? What if my kids' school is closing? Or what if they're going remote and we need to set up a home office? Like anything that can come up in like the next year of kind of COVID cleanup and getting used to like what life is going to be like and all the additional curveballs there'll be with openings and closings and openings again. Airlines are hoping that that flexibility encourages people to book travel.
The example of flexibility is, you know, one change that, as you said, nothing's permanent in the airline industry, but it's one change that's taking place now. But many people are finding the pandemic is a good opportunity to build back better. Are the airlines taking this opportunity?
They are. I mean, from a business standpoint, they are looking to get rid of costs wherever they can. I mean, better terms on some of their debt and things like that, cutting costs in other ways. If they don't have the revenue coming in, they're not going to be, you know, building out their first class cabins like they were and having the sorts of amenities and services that they were adding in the pre-pandemic kind of go-go days. But being a little bit more customer friendly seems to be a theme. I mean, how long that lasts, it depends on how long this lasts, pandemic.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with CNBC's airline reporter, Leslie Josephs. Leslie, you're working at arguably one of the nation's top news organizations, and we love our partnership with CNBC. Your group has been nice enough to let us speak to several reporters. A couple of weeks ago, we had your colleague Michael Santoli on as a guest. So we thank you for joining us. I'm curious, you cover the airline industry. What's the best part of doing that, and what's the worst part of doing that?
Oh, of covering it?
Yeah.
I would say the worst part is you never know what's happening. So, you know, like a Saturday afternoon, there's always some story. I wouldn't even say that's the worst because it's still an interesting story. So you never know what's coming. I would say that's the best and the worst part. Never a dull day. It's just interesting because this beat, and one reason why I love it is that it's the cross-section of consumer behavior, which is endlessly fascinating, politics, trade, technology, and then a whole bunch of personalities throughout the business.
And what's the worst part?
I don't really have anything bad. I mean, sometimes you get calls at 11 p.m. at night, but the story ends up being interesting. I mean, but you know,
those are the
really
fun.
Never really let your guard down.
Yeah, those are the fun calls for a reporter. I just asked because I'm a naturally curious person, and I didn't know where that would take us, so I wanted to ask it with enough time to follow up.
Yeah, no, it's.
It was a softball question. I apologize for that. Let me get to a tougher. Now that I've given you the softball, Leslie, let me give you the hard question.
Okay.
And you do this as a profession. I do this as a way to give back to my community, this show. I'm not a professional journalist, as you can probably tell. So let me ask you a tough question, which is, at the start of the pandemic, one of the first national programs that we did, as you mentioned earlier, bailed out the airlines in some ways. And there's many industries that, you know, didn't get that kind of support like the airlines did. What did the U.S. get? What did society get from bailing out? I know we saved jobs, which is really, really important. But are there route structures that maybe are in place today that, but for that, might have gone away? And how hard would it have been for those route structures to come back?
Well, airlines can add routes back. And like you mentioned, there is one part of the CARES Act when the original one that ended up being extended, it is on the verge of being extended for a third time, at least the terms of it, is that airlines have to keep minimum amounts of service. Even with that, airlines did apply for waivers to not operate routes that were unprofitable. So they kept a lot of service. They had to keep these minimum levels. If that stipulation wasn't in there, they would be able to cut whatever they wanted. And the same goes for employees. They likely would have cut many employees immediately if they didn't have sort of a cushion to keep paying everybody for so many months. So the airline's argument is that it maintains service, and also the, you know, Congress's viewpoint that passed this package and continues to pass this package for the airlines. One thing that's very difficult for airlines to do is bounce back quickly if they don't have the people. It takes weeks, if not months, to onboard a pilot, to get training in place. You have a backlog for training facilities at a lot of the large airlines right now. It's kind of like the hottest seat to get, because they're preparing for a time when demand, it's already rebounding and it's continuing to do so, but they need to make sure that everybody is ready to go on their plane, because there was so much movement. People retired, people took buyouts, so everyone kind of got moved around. So that's some of their argument, but there has been a lot of criticism of why didn't other industries get this? I mean, the hospitality, restaurants, anything related to tourism has just shed so many jobs. I think more affected than any other industry since the pandemic began, and they didn't get the same sort of job guarantees along the way. So I do hear that criticism too.
I want to move the conversation still on travel, but you know, back to more of the excitement and adventure of travel that many of us have been missing. What are the most popular destinations are you seeing for the spring and summer season?
Well, since the pandemic began, kind of the name of the game with any sort of travel has just been outdoors. It has a less, you know, smaller chance of catching the virus, and also a lot of indoor attractions, you know, museums, and not even indoor attractions, but like a lot of theme parks, at least in the beginning of the pandemic, were closed. Restaurants were closed, or at least operating at lower capacity. So outdoor destinations have really been central and are continuing to be that way, like through the summer. So destinations near national parks. Denver is one of the hottest airports just because there are so many attractions, hiking, skiing, I mean, you name it, outside. And that's kind of one of the airports that has actually weathered this much better than other airports. I think of the three New York area airports that have just almost completely lost business travel and international travel, especially in the beginning of the pandemic. So those have been doing really well. And beach destinations. Florida has been a hotspot. I mean, every airline seems wants to add service, or you see announcements every other day of new flights there. So it's just, you know, beach, mountains, ski has been very popular this year, and people don't have the number of options that they had before the pandemic. I mean, we can't go to Europe, and Europeans can't come here yet, and that won't happen until either more people are vaccinated and governments in both countries agree that it's safe to open up the border again.
Leslie, we need to let you go, but before I do, I'm going to ask for a favor. Bring out your crystal ball for us. It's a year from now. Everybody that's wanted a vaccine in the United States, I think we're still going to struggle worldwide to get vaccines into arms, but everybody in the United States that wants a vaccine has had a chance to get one. What does the airline industry look like a year from now?
I think for the most part, in the United States at least, airlines will stop losing money, or they will have stopped losing money in about a year. I think business travel will still be relatively scarce. I think leisure travel will be a little bit healthier. Just because leisure travel is going to come back in the coming months. I mean, how many trips can someone take a year? You know, it doesn't really take the place of business travel, which is frequent and high yielding. So I don't think that's going to be as popular, at least in a year's time. And I think they'll just be on more solid footing. Will it be the go-go days? No. I think it'll take years before we get back to the levels of profitability and revenue that we had before the pandemic.
Which means, Leslie, you're going to continue to have a very interesting job. We've been speaking with Leslie Josephs. She is, do I have this right? Yes, I'm sorry. We've been speaking with Leslie Josephs. I apologize. She is CNBC's airline reporter at CNBC. Leslie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Mountain Money will be back after this. Please stay tuned.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Well, this past week, KPCW had its winter pledge drive, and joining us this morning is General Manager of KPCW, Renee Bodily Miller, to tell us about how it went and the successes seen. Renee, thanks for being here.
Hey, good morning. It feels so weird to be in studio talking about pledge drive and not having a tambourine or a maraca or a xylophone or some kind of noisemaker. It's almost instinctual now, you guys, when you say, we made our goal. You want to like make some noise to celebrate that. We did make our goal. We went over, in fact. Our goal was $200,000. And with some weekend donations that came in, we counted all the pledges through last night. We ended up around $210,000. Again, those are preliminary numbers. There was a lot of paperwork and number crunching going on last week. So we'll have some final numbers coming up later for the board, probably in time for our April board meeting. Well, yes, in time for our April board meeting. Right, Doug? Y'all won't let me have an April board meeting without giving you the final
number. Hopefully there's plenty of time to prepare for that. You have a lot on your plate, though. I mean, it was a tremendous amount. It was a lofty goal. And it was a tremendous amount of work for you and your team. Give us a look behind the scenes. What does it take to put on a pledge drive like that?
It takes a lot of work starting several months out. So we have some volunteers who go out to local businesses to ask those businesses if they would like to make a donation to the radio station. In the form of gift certificates. It used to be more than gift certificates, but now with COVID, it's just easier to put a gift certificate in the mail to the donor. And I have to give a shout out to Marlene Peacock and Gary Peacock. They do a great job going out in the community and raising those gift certificates. A tough ask, right, during a pandemic when local businesses are facing their own challenges. So we're very grateful to those businesses who did make a donation. Hopefully they felt that they got something back by the many times we said their name over on the air over and over again. So it starts months out with that. And then we start reaching out to the various nonprofits in town to see if they want to host an hour. A lot of nonprofits want to do either summer or winter. A couple do both. Mountain Trails Foundation does both. Summit Land Conservancy does both. Peace House does both. Those tend to be the nonprofits that come on our air on a regular basis to do monthly reports or weekly reports.
And tell me about that. That has not always been the way we do our pledge drives. I love that. It has a great feel to it. It feels like a Park City way to do pledge drive. How did partnering with the non-for-profits come to be?
Came to be in 2019, I believe. It was winter 2019. At the last minute, we said, let's have some fun with this. We had asked the nonprofits to come in, and it wasn't every hour of the pledge drive. It was just a few hours here and there where the nonprofits had volunteered to come in just to help us raise money because they realized when KPCW thrives, so does the nonprofit community. And so we said, why don't we ask more nonprofits to come in and we will have a competition and we will say the top four nonprofits who get the top number of donors and the four nonprofits that raise the most money during their hour, we will give them free underwriting. Like first prize got $2,000 worth of free underwriting, second prize got $1,500. That changed in summer of 2020 where we said, it's a pandemic. Everyone needs all the help they can get. We had open inventory because underwriting was going down because people didn't have money for marketing. So we had space in our on-air schedule where we said, let's give every nonprofit that comes in free underwriting worth the amount they raise over $1,000. So then we thought we'll go out and get businesses to sponsor those nonprofits for $1,000. And some sponsors came in higher. I do want to give a shout out to some of those sponsors. May I do that right now? $5,000 matching grant from Utah Film Studios, that's Gary Crandall, that went towards the Peace House. And so that really inspired calls during that hour. Then Dr. Nicole McLaren put up a $5,000 matching grant for Summit Land Conservancy. She's an animal eye doctor. Then we had five sponsors at $2,500. That was Deer Valley, Vail, Promontory Foundation, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and the Iron Horse Business District for the Christian Center of Park City. So big shout out to Mary and Charlie Winsor. They have been big supporters of our pledge drive for a long time. Then $1,500 sponsors, that was Skyridge Development. That's over on the northeast side of the Jordanelle. They sponsored Mountain Trails Foundation, and that hour they talked about the trails they were building out there. Zions Bank Wealth Management Division, this is a new sponsor. They sponsored Park City Summit County Arts Council. Lots of talk about the importance of arts in the community during that hour. And then we had a surprise $1,500 sponsor. Mitchell Burns called in from Red Ledges on Friday during our DJ showdown. And they were trying to raise, I think they had $4,000 left to raise towards their $10,000 goal. And Mitchell texted me and said, put me in for a $1,500 challenge grant, which was awesome. And Red Ledges is a big sponsor of Leslie's show. So I had not reached out to them thinking, you know, I'm not going to get greedy and ask someone who's already an underwriter if they want to sponsor. And Mitchell came through for us, said thank you. Big shout out to everyone at Red Ledges. We had 10 $1,000 sponsors, Flanagan's on Main, High Star Ranch, Powder Bowie, Mike Ruzek, he sponsored Utah Avalanche Center, a realtor, John Walker with Engel and Volker, he came in on sponsored Mountain Town Music, and that was a fun hour. He's sitting in the studio with Brian Richards and Randy Barton. Can't find two cooler people in town than those guys. First Community Bank, they always sponsor Mountainlands Community Housing. Woodward sponsored Live Like Sam. Cole Sport sponsored Park City Ski and Snowboard. Senior Rippers, go to seniorrippers.com. It's a new blog in town about people over the age of 60 who like to rip it up on the slopes. They sponsored Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History. Mark Fisher sponsored Kimball Arts Center. He owns that property, the yard, where the Kimball's moving. Colony sponsored Park City Fire District. And Park City Lodging and Identity Properties sponsored Park City Senior Center. Momentum Recycling and the Stein Collection sponsored Recycle Utah.
And Renee, I think as we listen to you mention those names, both the for-profit groups as well as the non-for-profit groups, those are all organizations that are part of what makes Park City special. I mean, I was just blown away when I moved to Park City, just first off, this sense of community. And as I started to unpeel it and look into why is there such a sense of community here, it's really the not-for-profits are really a core fabric of it, and other pieces that make it easy to weave each nonprofit into this greater sense of community, which I think is part of the role KPCW does. Remind our audience, how do we help the not-for-profits here in town?
It is part of our mission statement. I say that over and over again. Part of our mission is to provide our services, our broadcast and digital platforms to all the area nonprofits. We have our own megaphone. Other nonprofits don't. So we want them to take advantage of what we can offer. So if you have an event, if you have a program, if you want to get the word out about what you're doing in town, email us and we'll put free public service announcements on the air. You hear our DJs reading that. Leslie will have you on the local news hour. Randy will have you on the local view. Our reporters will do a news story on it. That's what we're here for.
One thing that I just wanted to have you speak about, while people are listening to the pledge drive, it sounds like the studio is full, but what they don't see is that the rest of KPCW is buzzing because of the volunteers that you have. How many volunteers did you have come through the studio this past week?
Not as many as past pledge drives, Allison, because of COVID. So starting in August, Ethel had to winnow down her list of volunteers who normally come in. We had the same four phone volunteers in the morning hours and the same four in the afternoon hours. So big shout out to them. And we had the same four or five volunteers who are in here right now helping input the data. So normally it is 30 to 40 volunteers. It was about a dozen this time. And we had a big ask of those volunteers. Instead of coming in and doing 1 4-hour shift, can you come in 4 days in a row and do a 4-hour shift?
Well, special shout out to them for doing it. And Renee, congratulations again to you and your team at KPCW here. Job very well done. And thank you to our community for the great support that you showed us last week. You're listening to Mountain Money. We're going to be back in a moment to wrap up the show. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Mountain Money. We want to thank Renee for joining us and giving us that update. We want to thank also our great sponsors. We couldn't do this show without our sponsors, and they include Jan's Mountain Outfitters, First Community Bank, Columbus Pacific Development with Pendry Residences, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and San Francisco Design.
We had a great show today. We had three guests, and we started off the show with Charlene Walters with her new book, Launch Your Entrepreneur. We then followed with Leslie Joseph. She is with CNBC. She chatted with us about airlines and how things are turning around for them. And then, as you just heard, we spoke with Renee Bodley Miller, the general manager of KPCW.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed all of those conversations. The one that was most interesting to me was talking about the airlines, because it's kind of, it's symbolic to me of life getting back to normal. And Allison, you and I were talking in the green room ahead of time. I understand you have your vaccine scheduled for later this month. And I'm curious, any trips on the horizon for once you're fully protected from the virus?
At this time, no. I think part of what I'm waiting for is just to see where I can go where it'll feel normal. I think what Leslie was mentioning during her interview with the airlines was just that, you know, the typical outdoor destinations and places like that have been really seeing some success with tourism. But I want to, one of my favorite things is to go to an area and then kind of absorb myself and feel like I'm living there. And I just don't know if I'm going to get that same feeling for like the short term. I think
it's probably going to be a while. And speaking of tourist places that are doing well with outdoors, I know, fortunately for us, that's our industry here in Park City. Allison, in addition to the hat you wear so well here at KPCW as the producer of this show, another hat you wear is you're also the executive director for Park City Historic Main Street. Tell us how our businesses are doing this season.
Well, I think as we've been seeing all along, the businesses on Main Street have been doing well. I think it's hard to, you know, be able to drill down as far as how everyone's doing. But other than the loss of Sundance, I believe many of the businesses are having a very good year. So we are coming to the end of our show. You have been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money here on KPCW, located in Park City, Utah. We're going to be having you guys stay on the air because NPR is next.
You've been listening to Mountain Money, broadcast on KPCW, Park City, Utah. For more information, please visit kpcw.org. Please take a moment and give us a rating on your podcast app.